in deep learning.
Thank you. So thanks for inviting me. As I just told Andrea, I actually haven't yet decided what I'm going to speak about. So Andrea asked me to talk about optimization algorithms. There's really only one optimization algorithm, which is gradient descent or some slight variance we'll see in a second. So that would have been a pretty boring talk. And my original plan was to talk about how optimization looks from a learning perspective, and I will talk about that. I still have a few slides remaining from my original plan. But mostly what I'm going to be talking about is really the crucial role that optimization plays mostly in non-convex and in deep learnings. And so what I'm going to start with is actually not by talking about optimization per se, but start by talking about deep learning and try to understand deep learning. And from that, we'll get to seeing that understanding optimization is crucial for understanding deep learning. Then we'll maybe take a few minutes to see what we already understand about optimization in the convex case, where we do pretty much fully understand it, and go back to see what we should understand in the non-convex case. And I should say, I'll be actually, it's this cold tutorial, but I'll be shamelessly mostly presenting my results as examples, but mostly basically talking about my work, and this is work with a bunch of collaborators. In much of this, what I'm going to present is a work with Benham Nashabur, who was a student graduated 2 years ago, and is on the job market now, and Surya Gunsekar, a postdoc that's now also going in the job market. So if you like what you see here, these are the two main people responsible for almost all the results I'm going to discuss that came out of my group. There's many results, of course, from other people. Okay, so I said the starting point is deep learning or multi-layer perceptron, multi-layer network. So the way, just to get things straight in terms of notation, the way I view them, you have a fixed graph with a bunch of nodes. Each node is connected to a bunch of other nodes. There's a fixed activation function, and for any, each edge has a weight associated with it. And what we learn are the weights. Once we learn the weights, the output of each unit is given by a linear combination of the inputs going through the activation function, which is generally nonlinear. What we just defined is essentially a class of functions, all the fixed architecture, and have all the functions that are implementable by this architecture. And this just, from my language, from learning, this just defines the hypothesis class, similar as Sasha discussed on Monday. And now to understand learning with this hypothesis class, we have to answer three questions. And these are the questions that Sasha talked about on Monday. We have to first of all understand what is the capacity of this class, or the complexity of this class. How many functions can it represent? Because that will tell us how many examples do we need in order to learn. So if we have roughly speaking, the log cardinality of the class. I mean, maybe a bit more subtle than that. And it corresponds to some complexity. And this we actually understand fairly well for this class of functions I described, the class of neural nets. And not surprisingly, the basic answer is that the capacity roughly corresponds to the number of parameters. The number of parameters here is the number of edges. And so as long as the network is not too big, so it says a reasonable number of edges, maybe a number of parameters, then we can learn based on the number of sample size corresponding number of edges. So this is actually not exactly a correct answer. First of all, there's some log factors. That's not so interesting. The answer is correct if you either have hard threshold activations or you discretize the weights. It turns out that if you have soft activations and the weights are real valued, you can play all kinds of dirty tricks with the infinite root with very high precision real valued weights. And the capacity actually is more than number of parameters times depth, but we'll mostly ignore that. I mean, that does not seem to be a real phenomena. The main kind of message you should take from here is that the capacity is just number of parameters. So that's great. So now the next question we should ask is what actual functions is this hypothesis class good at capturing reality? Can we actually learn things that we want to learn and represent them with this class? And so there's lots of work in here. So first of all, there's work in approximation theory that tells us. Just think of a finite precision. Okay, you could also get results if you add noise. What I mean here is finite precision. I just represent each weight as a fixed precision number. I represent it with a you know, fixed point 16-bit number, I have 16 bits of precision. Okay. So this is, you can think of it as discretized weights. Okay. So you can represent any continuous function, but this result by itself is kind of useless, because to represent a continuous function, we need a network that's very, very, very large. And what we know is, in order to learn, we need to bound the number of the size of the network. So really, what we should ask is, what can we represent with small networks, not what we can represent with these huge networks. And there's lots of things that interesting things we can represent with small networks. I think at least one of the speakers has discussed this. And if you go to many people using deep learning, especially in vision, they'll tell you, I can tell you many stories about why deep networks are not too big, not too many edges, are great in representing visual phenomena, because you have low-level features and mid-level features and high-level features, and it's all like representable very efficiently. But the thing is that we don't actually need all these explanations, because we have a much better reason to know that with neural networks you can represent pretty much anything you want, even with a small network. And that's because, if instead of talking about continuous functions, I can talk about any function I can actually compute efficiently. Okay, so in learning, I want to learn, my view at least of learning, is I want to replace programming with learning. If I can't actually program anything, you know, if I give somebody a task of actually programming it, and he cannot, there's no way for them to write a short program to do what I want, there's no point in learning it anyway, okay, because there's no, the output wouldn't be useless anyway. So if I now limit myself only to things I can actually implement in a reasonable amount of time, then all those things I can implement with a network that's also fairly small. So any function I can implement in time t, I can also, in, you know, using a computer, right, is also realizable with a network of size roughly t. And this roughly depends on your exact model of computation, but the high-level message is the size of the network corresponds to the runtime. And this is really says that we don't need all these explanations about low-level features, high-level features, mid-level features. Really, we can represent anything we want with a network. So viewed only from these perspectives of generalization ability and expressive power, neural networks are great. In fact, they're a universal learner. Anything we might want to learn, we can represent with a small neural network. And in fact, we can learn small neural networks based on a relatively small number of examples. So in particular, if you combine these things, these two things together, anything you can represent with time t, you can learn using roughly t samples, which is, you know, amazing. Okay? So which one? So this is derived from a classic result in circuit complexity theory. So to get poly t is pretty straightforward. I'm not even sure who that goes to. And then there's a construction. I actually don't remember the more clever construction, get it down to linear, that I actually, maybe somebody here. I don't remember the reference. But it's like you can find it in any complexity theory book. So the only reason that hinders us is the question is, how do we actually fit the data? So if we have data, I mean, if I could take my data and actually find a network find the best setting of the weights that fits my data, then I could learn anything I want. But the question is, how do I do that? How do I solve this optimization problem? And this is where things get trickier, because of course this optimization problem is a hard optimization problem, and it's really hard. So the immediate thing to say, which is only sort of convincing, is it's NP-hard. Okay, so the problem of given a set of given data, finding weights that minimize the error on the data, or even more than that, just finding weights that give me zero error if it's possible, or deciding whether the zero error is possible or not, is hard even for the simplest possible network, even if for a network with just two hidden units. Okay? So that means that we cannot expect to have any algorithm that runs in polynomial time and is guaranteed to work for any data set. But this, I said, is only mildly convincing, because you can say, well, maybe I can do it. I mean, what I really want to do is just be able to predict. I don't care if actually finding the weights that actually generate this exact data. For example, maybe I can use a bigger network or a combination of networks or anything like that. But even that is impossible. So we have very strong results about impossibility of learning neural nets. So what these results say is that even if you have data that's generated by a neural network, okay, by a teacher network, by a very small teacher network, a teacher network with a single hidden layer and a super constant, I think I wrote here, okay, so now it depends again what complexity assumptions you rely on. You can even go down to super constant, let's say log d, so you have d inputs and you have only log d hidden units, so a fairly small with a single hidden layer, a very small network, and you have data that's exactly generated by that network, and now you're allowing yourself to use any structure, any model to learn, a much larger network, or a combination of networks, or a soft network, or whatever you want, there's no polynomial time algorithm that will be able to learn data generated by even a very small neural network. So these negative results are very strong negative results that basically tell us that even though it basically come directly from the strength of these positive results, because in some sense, so here we got it down to very small networks, but we couldn't have expected to be able to learn using neural networks, because we know that universal learning is not possible. I cannot actually learn any computable function, any efficiently computable function. And so if I could actually optimize neural networks, I could learn any polytime computable function, which I know is impossible. So we couldn't have expected to be able to actually do this efficiently. And what we see is that we can't even do it efficiently, even for tiny, tiny networks. There's a question there? So you can't approximate it even. So you can't, so the result is that if you have data, so there's no algorithm, no polytime algorithm, and if you have data generated by a tiny network, the network with the log D hidden units, will be able to output a predictor that's better than chance on the distribution. So also here you can't approximate at least in a useful way. So there are results in hardness of approximation. But if you could approximate it in a useful way, then you would be able to predict with better than chance, right? So you can't approximate it in a useful way. Does that answer that? Yes. Okay. Okay, yes. D here is the number of the input dimensionality. So I'm looking at hardness. Okay, so when you talk about hardness, I'm going to say polytime, poly in what? Yes. So I'm talking about polynomial in the input dimensionality. How does the complexity grow as the size of the patterns increase? And the number of units? Okay, so the amount of data you're allowed to have is, so when we talk about hard, so this says that with a polynomial amount of data, I mean, you cannot handle more than the polynomial amount of data anyway. So even if, yes, is there another question? Yes, so that's a very good point. So both of these results are worst case results, in the sense the worst case over the data distribution. So what it's easier to describe it for the NP hardness result, that just says that there's no algorithm that will work for any input data. Okay, for the hardness of learning result, yes, that says that there's no data distribution, so there's no algorithm that will work for any data distribution that's actually, so there's no algorithm that will work for any input distribution in any teacher network. Think of it this way, okay? And in the constructions, the input distributions are actually fairly benign. The teacher networks are chosen adversarially. So if you ask the question of, can I learn a random teacher network, that might be possible. Depends what the size and what random. But to me, that's kind of less interesting. Because a random, so when you say random teacher network, first of all, under what random, under what distribution, and the type of phenomena, I mean, we see, you have to make sure that that distribution is such that actually the realities we see are captured in the kind of typical set of that distribution, and that becomes, I mean, I don't know how to even start analyzing that. Right, so of course, so we'll get that, and of course it's not, right? So this created a very bleak picture, and this is why, I mean, if you ask definitely somebody in the theoretical sides of machine learning, and almost and all of machine learning in the, like, up to, the early 2000s or up to 2010 about neural networks, they'll basically mostly rely on these type of results and laugh it away and say neural networks, but you can't learn them. I mean, they're hard, okay? And what we, of course, see in practice is that we do succeed in actually training deep networks, okay? And learning with deep networks. And the question is why, okay? And the end is, so these are worst case hardness result, which means that there exists some distributions that we cannot fit efficiently. But it seems that the type of distributions we actually encounter in practice, the type of problems we encounter in practice, somehow we can actually fairly easily, even with just local search methods, succeed in actually optimizing on those, optimizing the training error on those. And the question is why? And to me, that is, if you ask of why do deep networks work, this is the real question of why deep networks work. Why do we succeed in optimizing? And so really, when we go to, I want to pick with anybody specific here, and also this is not maybe the right crowd, but if you go to like a vision researcher and you ask them, why do deep networks work? Why is learning with deep networks good for vision? Then what they'll do is they'll usually tell you stories about deep lower level features and mid level features, and basically ask this question about expressive power. But this is completely the wrong question to answer, okay? Because we know that expressive power is great. We already know that. We don't need to understand that for very specific problems. What we don't understand is this question. What we don't understand is why is it that for vision problems we actually succeed in optimizing? And just saying that that the data is captured exactly by a network, even by a very small network, doesn't provide us any evidence towards the fact that we can succeed in solving an optimization problem, okay? Because we know that this result specifically tells us that. So that means that, deep networks do work. I mean, I think it's undeniable that we've seen lots of empirical success. And so there's some magic property of reality. And that magic property, the only thing I can tell you about that magic property, it is not that it can be captured by a small neural network. There's some other magic property of reality, okay, that makes it possible to fit a neural network to solve the optimization problem on data drawn from reality. Okay? And so... Well, reality, I mean the type of problems, okay, when I say reality, there is a magic property of problems. And if you look at what problems, okay, not all of reality maybe we can learn with a neural network, right? But if I ask what characterizes a problem in which deep learning would work, okay? So what makes it possible to learn with deep, I take a problem. To me, a problem is just a joint distribution over X and Y, okay? What makes it possible to learn using deep networks? Okay? And what makes it possible to learn is that this optimization problem is easy. Okay? And so I claim that there's some property of distributions that make it easy to fit them. Okay? And if you want to understand why deep learning works, this is kind of the main question we should ask. What is this magic property that makes it possible to solve the optimization problem efficiently? Mm-hmm. And I would claim that we currently have almost zero understanding of that. Say. Yes. Yeah.
Without anything else.
Yeah.
It doesn't work.
So
you say practically works.
Yeah. Okay. So well, actually, I'm not. I'm not too convinced about that. So even in the first of all, okay. So I don't want to get into empirical argument of what works and what doesn't, but I should say that even just networks with sigmoidal activation, okay, at least convolutional networks with sigmoidal activation, there was success already in the 90s for digit recognition, for example. So, okay, but even for that problem, we don't understand why the optimization works, okay? And the second is fine. So it's true that it's not that all problems are easy to optimize, but there are many problems that are easy to optimize. And so this property is a property, you're right that this property is maybe not a property just of the distribution, but a property of the distribution and the architecture. But the important thing is it's not just a property of the architecture, because all these architectures, no matter what gates you have, and if you have ReLU activations or sigmoidal activations, or you have convolutions or whatever, all of these are hard to optimize. And so, in the worst case. And so in any case, what you'd be focusing on is having a property of the data distribution that makes it easy. The empirical?
Yes, I mean, if you take the typical benchmark that people study, like Cypher,
yeah.
Now, if you take an old multi-layer perceptron with mean square error and sigmoidal function, it doesn't work.
It does.
No.
For CIFAR, it definitely does. I mean, I actually will show that in the next slide, but. With ReLU, okay. With ReLU at least, not with sigmoidal, you're right. You're right. Okay, fine. So you're right. So I think what you're saying is that sometimes the optimization doesn't work. So that's true, and that's to me less surprising. What's more surprising to me is that sometimes optimization does work. okay, and frequently it does work. And I don't understand at all how to characterize the situations in which it does work. I want to maybe move on, so maybe just one, okay. Okay, so if you asked me to give a talk about deep learning and what you understand about deep learning 5 years ago, then this would be really the main point I would emphasize in the main talk I'll talk about, what is this magic property and how co-optimization works. And when I say works, I mean works in terms of finding a global minimum of the training error, okay, of the empirical error. But then about, was it 3-4 years ago at this point, we did an experiment, actually started from a different reason, that actually changed my view of what is the real mystery or what is an additional mystery of deep learning. So I would say we understand the generalization ability and expressive power very well, and the only question is about optimization. And then we did this experiment that Sasha actually already showed in his tutorial, but I'll show it again, because I basically showed this in, I think, every talk I've given about deep networks in the past few years. And what we did is as follows. We took fixed training data, we tried this both in CIFAR and in MNIST, and trained a neural network with increasing size. So on the x-axis here, you have the number of units. I should emphasize that this is not over the course of training. I mean, we trade completely separately with different networks of different sizes. And the black curve is the training error. So what we see is that the training error decreases as we increase the network size. It's not surprising. It can do a better job at fitting. And in fact, with 64 units, I can already perfectly fit the training examples. Okay? And now the question is, what happens to the test error? So initially, the test error also drops because, you know, I'm getting a better fit, so that's not surprising. And the question is, what happens beyond this point? So here, I'm not getting any better fit for the data. Yeah, I'm already fitting the data perfectly, but my model class becomes more and more and more complicated. So what I should expect, I mean, what I teach my students to expect, is that this curve should go up. And in fact, I mean, this is very mild. It should go up much more than that, because with 1,000 hidden units, there are already more parameters than training examples here. So with 1,000 units, it should just be through the roof somewhere up here. Okay? So this is what we expect to get, but this is not what you get. What you actually get is that the test error continues going down. So there are two things here that are strange. One thing is that it doesn't shoot up. I mean, how come with 1,000 units, right, we should expect that there's completely no reason, if you look at our explanations for generalization, we should not be able to generalize with a network with 1,000 units. Because with 1,000 units, I can, you know, I have more capacity, the number of training examples, I can fit anything. I have absolutely no way of generalizing. I have more parameters than data points, however way you want to look at it. And so how come I'm not overfitting? The second thing is, not only am I not overfitting, but I'm actually the test error continues dropping after I already have perfect fit. So what's going on here? Why is it improving? So it's not improving because I'm fitting the data better. Okay? It's not improving when I'm reducing what I'd call the approximation error, okay? Because it's already zero. It must be improving because some other reason. And the only sort of explanation for that is that the real capacity control, the real complexity control that's going on here, is not because of the size of the network, but there's some other hidden complexity control. In the network here, what I'm learning is actually it's becoming more complex in terms of the number of units, but it's become simpler in some other way that I, you know, I don't know what it is. Okay, and so. No, this plan is a stop and convergence. Stop and convergence for the training error. So this data is small enough for the loss, not for the training loss. So we did, so we stopped, okay. So you're right that we stopped when, so there's some subtleties here. This was actually a bit of an issue when we did this experiment, because the loss actually, I mean, it doesn't converge, as I'll talk about later. It actually diverges. But we stopped when the loss was extremely close to zero, or the training loss was extremely close to zero, well after the training error was zero. Okay, and that's actually important. If you stop when the training error is zero, and we'll talk about that later, that's too early. You have to continue optimizing much after that. I mean, you'd still get a decrease, but it wouldn't be as strong a decrease. Okay, that I'll be able to explain, actually, in hopefully. Actually, I don't know. I mean, I'm going to have to cut most of this tutorial. Okay, so where that puts us is that not only do we not understand optimization, but we actually don't understand capacity control and generalization either. Okay, and so really we're almost back to square one. So this is kind of what you want to see. And then as I'll show a bit, I mean, there's also optimization coming up here. So why is that? So first of all, what we saw is that the, you know, as we said, that the training error decreases. And what we kind of, what I just tried to argue is that really the main reason of complexity control is not coming from the number of units, but from some other notion of complexity, maybe relating to some size of the weights in some sense. And Peter Bartlett actually pointed out that this is not new news. I mean, back 20 years ago in 1996, they already observed also, I mean, in a different way, but also had works claiming that what's more important for generalization is not the number of units, but the size of the units. Okay? So let's try to test that. So what we can look at, this is the same plot we have. I'm just focusing here on the part where I already have zero training error. So the training error is always zero here, and I'm plotting the test error. And if we were saying that a decrease in test error is because we're getting a network that's simpler in terms of it has smaller weights, then I can plot the magnitude of these weights, the norm of the weights, and expect to see that the norm of the weights actually gets smaller as I increase in network size, even though the size becomes smaller, the size becomes larger, the weights become smaller, and that would, might explain generalization. If you actually do that, what you get is something like this. So the norm of the weights increases. Okay. Now, at this point, somebody should ask me, when I say the norm of the weights, which norm am I plotting here? Okay, what?
Is it? Which norm am I plotting?
Okay, so the norm I'm plotting here is just kind of the sum of squared of all weights in the system. So if they're kind of a vectorized L2 norm. And for many reasons, I mean, you can show that this is actually not the right norm to look at. It doesn't actually capture really what's going on in when you have multilayer networks. Okay? And so you can come start playing out with other norms. And if you play with enough norms, you'll eventually find a norm that actually does explain this. So I'm not claiming this is kind of the right norm, but another norm we played it is the path norm. So the path norm does look at a computational structure of the network. What it looks at is it looks at the sum of all the paths from input to output of the products of the weights along that path squared. Okay, so it's a norm that more also it captures a notion of the weights of the networks in a way that actually does capture the computational structure in some sense. Okay, and if you plot the path norm, this green line, then you do see that the path norm does decreases and does in fact maybe capture what's going on. So you can say that maybe network complexity is not captured by the number of units, but maybe by the path norm or some other norm. Okay, so fine. So this goes back to Peter's answer, and maybe we can explain generalization that way. And now we just have to figure out what is the right complexity measure? Which norm, or it doesn't even be exactly a norm. I mean, what complexity measure actually captures it? I mean, the path norm is one suggestion, and it's definitely not the correct one. There might be other related ones or completely different ones. So just a second. But now, the question is, how is this controlled at all? So if I look at this network with 1,000 hidden units, okay, then the network we found has a fairly small path norm and excellent test error. Okay, generalizes this very well. But actually, all we did here was just optimize the training error. So the optimization algorithm of training loss. All we did is just minimize the cross entropy loss. Okay? And so the cross entropy loss here has many. So there are many minima. There are many zero training error solutions. There are many different ways we can optimize the training error. Okay? Why did we get one with small path norm? Okay. So in particular, I can actually work much harder and find many other global optima. So all these points represent global optima of the training objective. So if I just put on my optimization hat and say optimize the training error, all of these are equally valid solutions. Okay. And as we can see, some of them have small path norm, many of them have large path norm. Okay. And you should not take this scatter as a distribution. I mean, this is specific ones that I plotted. In fact, almost all of them have large path norm. And the ones that have large path norm generalize horribly. Okay? So if our optimization algorithm actually returned one of these global optima, which would be a completely legitimate global optima for optimization algorithm, then we'd have horrible generalization. Okay? We wouldn't be able to generalize at all. Okay? So it seems that somehow our optimization algorithm, without being told to do so, is implicitly biasing us towards not just any global minima, but a very special global minima, a global minima that has small path norm, or maybe small other norm that's correlated with the path norm. Okay? And that maybe in turn is inducing generalization. Okay? And so the question, so tying this to optimization, as I said, that optimization, I started by saying optimization is key to understanding deep learning. Because if the capacity control is really coming from this bias towards simpler solution, from the fact that the real inductive bias, the real capacity control is not from the number of weights, but by some norm, this norm is only coming from the optimization algorithm. Okay? So How is this norm minimized by the optimization algorithm? Okay? And more than that, okay, I'll take your questions in a second, if I change the optimization algorithm for the same optimization objective, maybe I'm going to get different global minima. Okay? Will those change the generalization properties? So I'll take those questions there. So the initial conditions do affect things, but much less so. So let's talk about that at the end, actually. It'll be easier for me to answer that question. No, we did not do, so I think what you're asking is, did we do some checks of, you know, the entropy of the neighborhood around it? We did not. That would be interesting to do. And
one thing that we have shown is that if you minimize the cross-entropy, you are actually maximizing the density of the solution.
Right, so I'll get back to actually, again, I mean, so because I'll show something that's almost the same later. But on these experiments, we didn't check that. Yes? You're right. So this norm, these are not, there are many things that are not contained. And it's not, I mean, I don't have a good answer for that. And I don't think the path norm really is the right answer. We've looked at all kinds of other, you can come up with them. I mean, there's a whole cottage industry of that we've also participated in a bit, and others have, in coming up with different norms and trying to see how well they explain things phenomenologically. And this is definitely, measures of concentration or spread have been looked at. So it's, okay. Okay, so, yeah.
Is there a definition for path norm over all the paths that are for active
residue? No, okay, so that's a good point. So the path norm ignores the activations. Note that the path norm is a measure for the weights themselves, for the network itself. Without knowing the inputs, I don't know what's active and what's not.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's very important to say what kind of architecture, because if you're using a very silly architecture, then maybe some of the neurons are dead.
So it is a very silly architecture, and the whole point is that indeed some of the neurons are dead, but note that we're still benefiting from the fact that we're increasing. So something is happening, so there's two questions. First of all, why do these networks, even if just some networks are dead, why do these networks die? Why do these units die? Why they're not used to overfit? And the second is, we are actually taking advantage of more units, because you know the test area is decreasing. Okay, so let me go on here. So as I said, we can ask what happens when we change optimization algorithm. And in fact, if we change optimization algorithm, we're going to change the inductive bias, get to different places, and have different generalization properties, and we can definitely see it. So this is one set of experiments. This is training with SGD as opposed to path SGD, which is, it doesn't matter for this discussion exactly what it is. It's approximate steepest ascent with respect to this path norm. The point is that both of these optimization algorithms, as optimization algorithms, perform great. They both optimize the training objective, which is the cross-entropy loss, which is what they're supposed to do. They get to a global minima. I know they get to global minima because they get to zero error, which is, you know, the best you can get. So they're both doing, as optimization algorithms, they're great. They both find a global minima, okay? But the global minima that path SGD finds is better. In what sense is it better? It's better in the sense that it generalizes better. It has a better test error. No, this is not, okay, this is a different notion of better than what's usually considered an optimization, because again, this is better not in terms of optimization objective, but in terms of objective that I didn't ask the optimizer to look at, okay? But I get to, you know, like, both of these get to global minima, but one global minima is somehow better than the other, okay? So so in order to understand why am I generalizing better, I have to look not at optimization objective, but the actual optimization algorithm, okay? And you can see this also with the, let's jump to here. Adam is a variant of SGD that's used frequently in practice. It kind of tries to adaptively tune the per coordinate learning rates. And in terms of optimization, Adam is actually a bit better than SGD. So at least in this experiment, and this is frequently happens, Adam converges faster in terms of the training objective. Okay? Both Adam and SGD here would converge to roughly the same training objective. So in terms of optimizing, again, they're both doing a good job. Adam is doing it a bit better, a bit faster. Okay? But again, the global minima, I think it's global here, I can know for sure, that Adam converges to is much worse than the one that SGD. SGD converges to a better global minima. And when we say better, it's better in terms of this generalization property. So I can't even tell you in terms of like properties of the optimization better in what way. Maybe it's higher norm in terms of some norm, but I don't even know what norm. Okay. And so really, what I'm trying to convince you here is that all of the inductive bias, or at least most, I would say almost all the inductive bias in deep learning is coming not from the optimization function, not from the optimization objective, but from the optimization the way we do the optimization. So in other words, when we look at, we have a flurry of new papers on deep learning. And the way the typical, how we usually look at this, we come up with some architecture, and this architecture defines, and then we say how do you optimize this architecture? Well, optimizing is very easy. We just do argmin of the training loss on our architecture. Okay? And how do we do that? Well, we use some optimization algorithm, the details are maybe in an appendix, in a good case, maybe not in an appendix, only in the code. Okay? And the thing is that this doesn't tell me at all what the learning rule is. Because the learning rule is not this argument. This argument is a bad learning rule in many cases. There are ways to solve this argument that would not generalize at all. Okay? So all the inductive bias, all the bias that tells me what solutions I should prefer simpler solutions or more complicated ones, all of it is happening inside here. Okay? So really the picture you should have in mind is as follows. So we're training way over-parameterized networks, way over-parameterized models. And I think much of the success, the empirical success of deep learning is because we're in this way over-parameterized regime. Okay? So if you're training an over-parameterized model, there are many zero-error solutions. So you can kind of think of it as the oceans, right? There are many in your landscape. There are lots of oceans that are ground level, zero level, sea level. Okay? And you're going to start optimizing on the top of some hill. Okay? You're going to stop optimizing, and then you're going to go down, and you're going to get, if optimization works, which is a separate issue, you're going to get to a zero-error solution. And the question is, there are many zero solutions, which zero solution are you going to get to? You're not going to get to something in the middle of the ocean. Okay? You're going to get to a beach. But which beach do you get to? So if we start optimizing here, I'm probably going to get to some beach here, I don't know, in Goleta or Santa Barbara or something like that. I'm not going to somehow jump to the Arctic Ocean. Okay? If I start optimizing in somewhere in Massachusetts, I'm going to go down, and I'm probably going to get down to somewhere in the Atlantic. Okay? The question is, what happens if we start optimizing in Chicago? Okay? So Chicago is extremely flat. Okay? So Chicago really, it's so flat that the rivers go backwards, flow backwards. Okay? You can get from Chicago just by going down, you can get anywhere. Okay? You can get to the Arctic, to the Atlantic, to the Gulf of Mexico. And the question is just now, which direction does your optimization algorithm prefer to go? If your optimization algorithm prefers going south, maybe you're going to get to the Gulf of Mexico. If your optimization algorithm prefers going east, you're going to get to the Atlantic. Okay, and so all so what you're going to get roughly is to the closest beach. But the question is closest under which metric? Okay, and this closest is really your main inductive bias. Your main complexity control is not by saying you're going to get to zero error. It's by saying you're going to get to the closest beach. But this notion of closest is intrinsically tied to the optimization algorithm. So really, in order to understand what we're actually doing in terms of learning, we have to understand what are the biases induced in terms of the optimization algorithm, which come. No, but you're going to get. But not all beaches are equal, right? Some beaches, different beaches, are going to have different properties. I do care about which beach I get to. Okay, so different.
This is
yeah. So I care if I get to it is important for me whether I get to the beach that's closest to me in L1 norm or the beach that's closest to me in L2 norm, for example. Okay, this is actually I don't know if you can see in this figure, but this is actually here one of them is L1 norm, minimum L1 norm, one is minimum L2 norm. But what's good? What is good? Okay, so I'm kind of defining good as close. What does good mean? Good is not, the point is it's not good in terms of the optimization objective. Okay, I'm going to get to a beach which is close to me. Okay, and what I'm arguing that what makes it good is it's close to me. If you start in the origin, close is roughly the same as small norm. I mean, this is very vague. Okay, but it has its small complexity. We'll actually make this a bit more concrete in a bit. Okay, and so what I'm claiming is that the inductive bias of deep learning comes from the fact that you're not just finding a zero training error solution, you're finding a zero training error solution that implicitly minimizes some complexity control. And this implicit complexity control is your notion of closeness. And if you change that implicit notion of complexity control, you're completely changing your learning rule. Okay, so I do care close in what sense. Maybe this will become, okay, I see that I'm way behind time. I have concrete examples where you can actually work out analytically that might make some of this clearer. Quick question?
Yes. So you say that there are some algorithms that really doesn't work. Which are, because
Oh, so you're right. So the thing is that all reasonable algorithms work reasonably well. To get there are algorithms. So as I showed you, so if I showed you these examples that really don't work, it's actually very difficult to get them. You have to use a completely ridiculous, not something you'd actually use, algorithm. They're still legitimate solutions of the optimization problem, but they're not a result of any reasonable algorithm. So if you use reasonable algorithm, I mean, this is not something that makes sense, this is something we're trying to understand, right? But if you use reasonable algorithms, you seem to get to reasonable places, okay? But still, some places will be much better than others, okay? It is possible to get to completely unreasonable places, but you know, but still, all the inductive bias is from reasonableness. And we'll actually see examples also that reasonable algorithms don't work at all. Let me, okay. Yeah, right.
Not only the loss function. However, if you don't compare different loss function, how can you claim that it's invariant?
I am also looking at different loss functions. But again, I'm claiming that still much of the inductive bias comes from the dynamics optimization. I'll return to this point. I'll make it even stronger. And then let me try to continue because I'm seeing I don't have much time, right? So, I mean, there's discussion during the thing, so maybe I'll allow myself to go a bit. So what I'm claiming is again, that what's central to me here, I think of this in terms of geometry. That the geometry of the inductive bias, the geometry like you know, L2 norm, L1 norm, and the geometry of optimization. I want to tie these together. So I'm trying to explain. I'm gonna try to explain them in the context case. So basically, what we see is that we have two mysteries of local search. These are the two mysteries I plan to talk about, but maybe I'm not going to talk about. So the first one is how come we find global minima in the first place? What's this magic property that makes its optimization actually goes to global minima? And the second is, which is to me more important and maybe the only one I'll talk about today, is how does the local search bias us towards specific solutions and which solutions? Can we relate the optimization algorithm and the solution it biases towards? So I'm talking about the relationship between optimization and geometry and how is optimization related to the specific optimization algorithm related to specific geometry. So I will take a few minutes to talk about, to give my original tutorial or like an excerpt from my original tutorial really quick, just to maybe understand this relationship between optimization and geometry, because in the convex case, we understand the relationship between geometry and inductive bias and optimization very, very well. Okay? So I'm going to start from the beginning now. How is optimization relevant for learning? So one way optimization is relevant for learning is when we use learning for optimization. So let's start with the goal for optimization, the goal of learning. The goal of learning, from my perspective, is to find a good predictor. So I have an unknown source distribution over x and y, and I want to find a predictor h that has small error on the population. That's my goal. How can I do that? I collect samples, and then on these samples, I can actually write down the empirical error for these samples, and now I can try to find a predictor that minimizes the empirical error in some constrained class that provides capacity control. Okay, so that's a reasonable way of learning, known as empirical risk minimization, and now solving this argument amounts to optimization problem. And much of learning is around that, either fixed to fixed hypothesis class, or I can think of adding some regularizer and now my inductive bias is not by saying that I want to be in the small hypothesis class, but I want this C to be small. But this is really almost the same because adding a regularizer is almost the same as just constraining the level of this regularizer. I mean, both of these is very lambda or B would essentially produce the same set of solutions. And so I'm not going to really make a strong distinction between these because adding a regularizer, from my perspective, is the same as just limiting to hypothesis class, which is a sub-level set, right? So if I'm adding an L2 regularizer, it's like saying my hypothesis class are balls of some radius, okay? The standard analysis kind of treats learning and optimization separately. So I have, first of all, a learning guarantee, which tells me how well do I solve these arguments, and then an optimization guarantee, and I have a learning guarantee that tells me how well will this argument do on my population, and this is usually done, and I think Sasha gave an entire tutorial this on Monday, looking at saying that the empirical means and the population and empirical means are close for all predictors in this class, and so we can argue that if we actually minimize the empirical error, we also get good generalization error, good population error. Okay, so let's see how this plays out for a specific problem. And again, this is my favorite simple class, just a class of linear predictors with bounded L2 norm. Okay, and this is what happens in support vector machines if you want to think about something concrete. Okay, so in this case, again, this argument is the predictor with the bounded norm predictor with the minimal error. And we have the learning guarantee, and the learning guarantee tells us that if we actually do that, we get something that's the best we can do, the best we can possibly do in our class, or the best possible prediction we can have with small norm, plus error term, which is roughly square root of norm squared over number of samples. Okay, great. But now, how do we solve this arg then? So we need to optimize it. We can optimize it using gradient descent. So we solve it using gradient descent with some appropriately chosen step size. We can say that in order to get a small suboptimality, so now this is a learning guarantee. This is an optimization guarantee. I'm telling you how well am I actually optimizing the empirical objective? How close am I to optimizing the empirical objective? And I have a suboptimality term here, which is roughly square root of radius squared over number of iterations, okay, of the optimization algorithm. Now, instead of using gradient descent, in order to use gradient descent, every iteration, I have to calculate the full gradient of my objective. Okay? And if I have billions and billions of examples, calculating the full gradient might be very expensive. It turns out that instead of calculating the full gradient, I can get away with calculating the gradient just in a single point. Okay, so this is an instance of stochastic gradient descent. Okay, so in each step, I take a step which is based on the gradient in a single x, I, y, I chosen randomly from the training set. Okay, and the main the crux here is that even though this is a very crude estimate of the actual gradient, it's an unbiased estimator for the gradient. So I'm taking a step in the direction of some stochastic gradient, where the expectation of the stochastic gradient is exactly the gradient that I actually want to descend on, the gradient of the empirical error. Okay? And happily enough, at least with the right set of assumptions, the number of iterations I need to optimize, even though each step is much, much weaker, the number of steps I need to optimize is the same. So roughly speaking, I don't really need in order to do a good job optimizing, I just need to roughly go in the same direction. I don't need a very, very good estimate of the direction I need to go. Just an high variance unbiased estimator is still good enough. Okay, but this is just a suboptimality guarantee, and as we said, what we really really care about is how well does this predictor that we learned this after t iterations, how well does it actually generalize? What's its error in the population? So in order to do that, what we need to do is combine this optimization guarantee with the learning guarantee and say that the total population error we get was the best population error possible, plus whatever we lose from the fact that we only have a finite number of samples, plus whatever we lose from the fact that we didn't actually optimize, we never optimized the whole way, we just have some suboptimality, we don't exactly solve the argument. Now, this is kind of curious, because if I ask me how many, you see here, and this came up a bit in Sasha's talk, I think at some point somebody asked, wait, is T or M or N or whatever letter that Sasha uses, is that number of iterations or number of samples? Okay, so we already see that they're actually behaving in a very similar way. I mean, both of them in particular, I need them to be of order norm squared over epsilon squared in order to get epsilon generalization. So roughly speaking, you see that I need the number of iterations to be roughly the same as number of samples. But actually, we can make this connection much, much stronger than that, because the same algorithm here, and I think this is the maybe most important point of convex optimization for learning, the same algorithm here that I described as stochastic gradient descent on the empirical objective, I can actually reinterpret it as stochastic gradient descent on the population objective. Because I said, what does it mean to do stochastic gradient descent? That at each iteration I take a step so that the expectation of the direction I take is the gradient of my objective function. So instead of thinking of my objective function as an empirical error, think of my objective function as the population error. This is really what I care about. If I pick x, I, y, I at random, okay, from the distribution, and my samples are random samples from the population, then this is actually a stochastic gradient estimate of the population objective. Okay? So that means I can think of stochastic gradient descent as an optimization algorithm for the population objective. And now if I apply the stochastic gradient descent optimization guarantee, I directly get a learning guarantee. So now I'm not distinguishing anymore between optimization suboptimality and learning suboptimality, the optimization guarantee and the learning guarantee. SGD optimization guarantee itself is actually a learning guarantee because it tells me how good I am on the population objective. Okay? Now, in order to do that, I need my samples not only to be unbiased estimators of the population, I also need to be independent of each other. So that means I'm only allowed to use each sample once. I'm not allowed to reuse samples. So this happens at least if I'm doing kind of one pass over the data. Okay? Number of federations is equal to number of samples, which is what I need to do anyway. Okay? So that means that we have actually a strong connection here. And here, I actually, when I created the slide, I couldn't decide whether to write here T or M. Both of them are correct. The number of federations is the number of samples. Okay, so quick question? Or? Right, so that's important. So for this, in order to do this, I'm only allowed to do one pass. Actually, you can also analyze what you do if you do a few passes, and that's still okay. But you can do many, but roughly, yes, T cannot be larger than M. Okay, so now what's going on here? Now, I want to emphasize that, so what we're seeing is we're getting an optimal learning guarantee after one pass. So in fact, one pass SGD is an optimal learning algorithm. Okay. So what does that mean? I want to emphasize that it's not that after one pass of SGD, I already optimized the empirical error. Okay, but rather, after one pass of SGD, what I get is I get to a distance of roughly 1 over square root of m from the best thing I could do in the population. And ERM also get to roughly the same distance, and also roughly the same distance from the ERM, right? So basically, there's this neighborhood of 1 over square root of m that's the best I can get to the population anyway with m samples. Okay? That's where the ERM lives, and I get to that neighborhood after m iterations. If I continue optimizing, now going back to that question, if I insist on continue optimizing with the same samples, now I cannot say that I'm doing SGD on the population because I don't have, if I look at it in terms of population, I don't have independence. And now what's going to happen is, well, it depends. If I have projection steps, I'm going to converge to the ERM, which is defined as the minimum of empirical error subject to the norm constraint. If I don't have a projection, I'm just going to overfit. So what we saw here is really that we started by talking about using optimization for learning, but really, learning is optimization. Okay? The learning problem, as I defined it, of finding a predicted and minimizing the population error, is actually a stochastic optimization problem. Okay? So what's a stochastic optimization problem? I want to minimize some expectation. In my case, it's this expected loss. But without knowing this distribution, only based on samples from the distribution, or maybe estimates of being able to get estimates of the objective, or gradients estimates of the gradients of the objective, which is exactly what we got here. Okay? So really, machine learning is just a special case of stochastic optimization, and in fact, supervised learning is a special case. But Vapnik in his book defined the general learning setting. And in Vapnik's general learning setting, when he talks about minimizing any stochastic functional, is exactly equivalent to kind of Nemirovsky's definition of stochastic optimization. These are exactly the same problems. Okay? So really, and this is something that unfortunately we discovered only fairly recently as communities, and really realized that everything is the same. The only difference is the notation, right? So you'll see in this talk that frequently give talks both optimization, the kind of learning theory, and the NIPS crowd, occasionally also to statistics. And so you'll see also that my notation in this, I apologize in advance, some of the W's should be X's, some of the X's are W's, occasionally an H will come up. I don't think I have any betas, although I sometimes do have betas. And this is, maybe I should add here, physics, where this is maybe the configuration or the state, right? So this is, how long do I have? Because now I'm getting really nervous. 25 minutes. Okay. So I just say this is. I think it's because I said that the exact same framework was devised by two giants, Vladimir Vapnik, who thought about it in terms of learning, defined statistical learning or generalized learning setting, and Arkady Nemirovsky, who formalized stochastic optimization. From what I understand, they were working in the same building, in the same institute in Moscow. What? That's what this like mathematical control. That's what Arkady. What? That's what Arkady told me. Okay. Anyway, definitely both working in Moscow at the same time. They knew each other, but they did not make a connection between their work. I mean, the connection between their work was made several decades later. So why is it that they both developed essentially the same framework, but in completely different directions? And so, really, their focuses were very, very different. Okay? Arkady's focus was on computational efficiency, on optimization. He started from optimization, statistical consistency, but still, you want to get efficient algorithms. Vladimir Vapnik couldn't care less about efficient algorithms. For him, once you write the argument, you're done. Okay, just argument is an algorithm. Okay, and so the focus was only in the sample complexity, what you can do with a limited number of samples. And then this also changed what type of problems they look at, because since Nemirovsky was interested in efficient algorithms, he looked mostly in mostly on convex objective over norm vector spaces, and the notions of complexity control that Nemirovsky looked at were different norms and geometrical notions of complexity, because everything was in a sort of norm vector space. Okay? Whereas Vapnik developed a much more general combinatorial theory that talked about abstract hypothesis classes, and the complexity control was in terms of combinatorial notions, like the VC dimension or fat shattering dimension came a bit later, and later on, Rademacher complexity was used for these notions. So these are all generic kind of combinatorial notions that can be applied to any class of functions. Okay? Convex, non-convex, doesn't matter. Okay? When we limit ourselves to convex classes over norm vector spaces, then the two theories kind of agree and are talking exactly about the same thing. Okay? So let's go back to this. And so what we see here in particular is that the Vapnik analyzed the RM, Nemirovsky analyzed stochastic gradient descent, and both give us the same answer. Okay? Now, there's something mysterious here. How come SGD actually gives us the optimal learning rate? And it's not just the optimal learning rate, the optimal learning rate for this very specific hypothesis class, the hypothesis class defined by the bound and L2 norm. Okay? Where is the L2 norm? So when you talk about ERM, the L2 norm is very explicit. I look at the minimum error subject to constraint in the L2 norm. Okay? So the L2 norm is very explicit in my learning rule. Okay? But if I look at about SGD, SGD is just, there's no L2 norm there. All I do is keep subtracting gradients. Where is the L2 norm hiding in the definition of SGD? What ties SGD specifically to the L2 norm? Why not the L1 norm or something completely different? Okay? So where's the regularization? So what I claim is there is definitely regularization hiding in SGD. In order to see that, let's derive SGD a bit better. And particularly in a way that's maybe a bit more well-funded than just saying that I'm subtracting gradients from iterates, because I can't even do that. The gradient is an object in a dual space. I can't add vectors in the dual space to vectors in my primal space. And it's like adding a row vector and a column vector. Our programs should really crash when you do that. So how can we actually justify stochastic gradient descent and see the regularization explicitly? So what are we doing when we're doing stochastic gradient descent or gradient descent? Well, the first thing we're doing is we're building a linear approximation of our function. Great. So we have this using a gradient to build a linear approximation of our function. And now we want to minimize this linear approximation. But when we minimize this linear approximation, if we just said minimize this linear approximation, the minimum would be way over here. Okay, that would be a very bad place to go to. Why do we not want to go to this place? Because over here, my linear approximation is actually a very bad approximation from an objective function. Okay, my linear approximation is a good approximation locally. So what I want to do is stay close to my iterate, where my linear approximation is actually good. So what I'm going to do is minimize my linear approximation plus a proximity term that constrains me to stay close to where I started. And this proximity term is going to be It's a squared L2 norm. Okay? So squared L2 distance. And this is where the specific choice of the L2 distance goes very explicitly into stochastic gradient descent. Okay? Now, if you set it like this, this is just a quadratic objective. I can solve it in closed form. And I get from this exactly the gradient descent step or stochastic gradient descent step, depending on whether G is a full gradient or stochastic gradient. Okay? Now, so this is linked directly to the Euclidean geometry. So the gradient descent, in my mind, is very directly linked to the Euclidean geometry. What happens if I want to work over other geometries? If my hypothesis class now is not a ball, but maybe an L1 ball, maybe it looks like this, or in high dimensions, has all kinds of different shapes. My notion of simplicity is not an L2 notion, but some other notion of simplicity. Okay, what is the right thing to do there? So in the convex case, we have all the answers. Okay, and the right thing to do is, instead of using gradient descent, to use mirror descent. And I'm not even going to define it, but given any complexity control psi, any potential function or simplicity function, whatever you want to call it, psi, regularizer, the right thing to do is to replace the L2 norm here with a divergence with respect to that potential function. And the main thing you should maybe, the one way to think of this potential function, or this divergence function, is that, so this is the mirror descent step, which is defined for finite step sizes, and you can derive, you know, the guarantees here for how many steps you need and so forth. But if you take this infinitesimally, so if you just ask, you know, what happens when you take an infinitesimally small step size, and so WT plus 1 is going to be close to WT, then what you care about is only a second order approximation of this potential of this divergence. And second order approximation of this divergence is just given by a quadratic form in terms of the Hessian of the potential function. So maybe here you can see it more directly how the choice of the potential function influences the local geometry under which you're optimizing. Okay, so at each step, what you're going to try to do is you're going to try to take a small step in your objective, okay, in order to improve in a small step in your iterator in order to improve your objective. But the question is, how do you measure what is a small step? So it's a small step in terms of the geometry that's given by the Hessian of this potential function. So the Hessian of this potential function is what defines to me the local geometry. Okay? And I get a step that, you know, my step is going to look something like this. Okay? And this is also sometimes called natural gradient descent. It's just, you can think of it just as an infinitesimal approximation to mirror descent. Okay, so in ASS, in the convex case, we understand this very well. Okay, we know how to get, and when you say we, I mean it goes back to Nemirovsky, we know how to get optimization or generalization, same thing, guarantees for mirror descent in respect to potential function, respect to, you know, in terms of property like strong convexity and boundedness and other properties of the potential function. In some sense, this is even universal. So in some sense, any convex learning problem you can solve optimally with mirror descent just by choosing the correct potential function. Okay? And so really this is what I mean when I say that in convex case we kind of know all the answers. Okay? So in particular, our inductive bias is encoded in our optimization algorithm through the choice of this to this local geometry. Okay, so in the convex case, we understand completely the link between geometry, optimization, and generalization. Okay? And I should emphasize that in the convex case, at least, this comes from kind of early stopping, because it comes from the fact that we're only going to do kind of one pass over the data, or maybe a few passes over the data, okay? Not what we saw before, which is we continue optimizing all the way to the end. Okay? That we're going to return to now. Okay, so I should say that this is the more kind of theoretically sound development is for mirror descent. But a close cousin of mirror descent is steepest descent, which again you can think of more heuristically as an optimization algorithm derived from a geometry. So now if I have a more cruder sense of geometry that's defined by any, you know, I won't even call it distance function, any measure of how similarity measure of between W and W prime, I can just syntactically define steepest descent, which just takes a step, which again is exactly the same form. It tries to minimize my approximation plus a term which says me I'm not going to allow to get too far away in terms of this distance function, or distance measure, whatever. Okay. So if I use Euclidean distance, what I get is exactly gradient descent. And I get interesting things if I put other norms there. These are not, I should emphasize, actually divergences. So if I use the L1 norm, is a measure of distance. So I want to take the step, each time the step is smallest in the L1 norm and has the greatest effect on my objective. What do I get from that? No. Okay, so I have a limited budget in terms of L1 norm. Okay, where should I put it? I should put it in the coordinate that has the strongest partial derivative. So what I get is coordinate descent. Okay, I should put it kind of all my budget in a single coordinate. Okay, on the other extreme, if I take the L infinity norm, now we know each coordinate I have is independent budget, and the optimization algorithm I get is this sort of going in the direction of the sine, the element-wise sine of the gradient. So you can get all kinds of many optimization algorithms, many local search methods. You can get derived as either a natural gradient, is either mirror descent or steepest descent with respect to some geometries. And here the link between geometry and optimization is still very clear intuitively, but it's not, you know, this actually doesn't kind of completely work. Theoretically, we don't get the optimal rates here theoretically. Okay, so the problem is that in the remaining 20 minutes, if what I understand, 15 minutes, something like that, we're going to leave the convex world behind, which is very sad because I'm going to stop understanding what's going on for the most part. And now we're going to ask what questions should we ask in a non-convex case? Okay, so one question we should ask is how fast do we converge? Okay, how fast do we get to whatever we converge to, the stationary point, whatever, how fast do we get there, how many iterations? So this is the main question that concerns us in a convex case, and I'm actually going to not, I wasn't even planning on talking about that, I think it's less relevant than Scott. There is a lot of recent work on that that kind of extends the work from the convex case. But in a non-convex case, in addition to asking how fast do we converge, we should also ask where do we converge to. So this is a question that mostly doesn't exist in the convex case because generally we converge to the global minima, and at least if you're strongly convex, it's even unique. Okay? And when you ask where do we converge, again, we can break this up to two questions. Do we converge to a global minima? How good is what we converge to in terms of optimization objective? This is kind of relates to the first mystery. And then we can further ask, okay, we converge to maybe a global minimum, but which global minimum? Which of the many global minimum we converge to? And this is the second mystery. So actually, I'm going to skip this and jump straight to the second mystery. So let me just, let's jump straight to the second mystery. So where do we converge to? Okay, so how can an optimization algorithm, even if we optimize to convergence, bias us to specific global minimum? It's very good. So let's start with a simple example, which is this least squares. Okay? So least squares, I have an over-parameterized, underdetermined least square problem, okay? And I'm going to optimize this with respect to W. Now there are many, it's underdetermined, there are many zero-error solutions. Which zero-error solution do I go to if I optimize using gradient descent? Okay? So the answer is that if I start at least in the origin and optimize with gradient descent, I'm always going to get to the minimum norm solution. So not just any solution, but exactly minimum norm solution. And actually, this would happen even if I use stochastic gradient descent, conjugate gradient descent, use momentum, no matter what I use, because an easy way to see this is the solution I'm going to get to is always going to be spanned by the gradients, okay? And the gradients are always going to be spanned by the data. And so I'm always going to remain in the span of the data. And the unique solution that's spanned by the data is actually the minimum norm solution for least square problem. Okay? So we already see for least square problems that for an underdetermined problem, how just by the choice of optimization algorithm, so it depends how you initialize BFGS, it depends how you initialize the Hessian. Okay, so.
But the other is M less than M.
Though. Sorry, did I miss the N and M? I should have N. This is the other way around. Sorry, the inequality here is the other way around. And I have N much, much larger than N, many more parameters and equations. Okay. And so we already see an example how we get to a very nice and very solution we would want, like minimum norm solution, just by the choice optimization algorithm. This is not encoded in the problem statement at all. Okay. And we are not surprised when we get to minimum L2 norm solution, because as we saw before, there's a very strong link between gradient descent and L2 norm. So if you just ask me without thinking about this at all, you know, which solution I get to if I use gradient descent? Well, probably going to be the minimum L2 norm, not the minimum L1 norm. If you use coordinate. Okay, so we'll get to that later, actually. The answer is generally no. we'll get to that in a second. But let's see a more interesting case. And now this is a case, so I said that our goal is to understand deep learning. Deep learning is very complicated. And I think Surya, who I think has gone already yesterday, started looking at, and when we talk about deep learning, I can't really understand deep learning, but let's start at least with two-layer networks with linear transfer. Okay, so that's at least we can start understanding why two-layer network with linear transfer is essentially a matrix factorization problem. And matrix factorization is something that I've been working on in a long time, and that at least I somewhat understand. So let's look at that. So in particular, to get to that, we're going to look we're still going to look at linear regression with least squares, but instead of looking at a vector argument, we're looking at it as a matrix argument. So far we didn't do anything. We just changed, you know, how we write W. It's now going to be a matrix, and n by n matrix. And I have linear observations over these metrics. And to be concrete, these linear observations could be general, but you can think of them as just observing single entries from the metrics. Okay? The important thing is I have much fewer observations, the number of parameters. So I have n squared parameters and maybe 20 n observations. Okay? And they still am going to solve this least square problem. So this least square problem is the stupidest problem ever. It doesn't make any sense. Okay? It's way over-parameterized. I have many solutions, and most of these solutions, it's very easy to solve. For example, one way to solve it is completing all the observed entries and putting a value of 73 everywhere else, or completing all the observed entries and writing the Fibonacci sequence in all the other entries. There are many, many different zero error. All of these are global minima of the optimization algorithm, and they're all pretty horrible. Okay? And in fact, if I do gradient descent with respect to W here, what I'm going to get is exactly the solution of completing the observed entries and putting zero everywhere else, because the gradients are not going to touch anywhere else. So that's not a very good solution. But now let's see what happens if I just change the parameterization here. So I'm going to parameterize W as U times V. Okay? So and the important thing here is U and V are full dimensional. So W is N by N, U and V are also going to be N by N. And so what I did is just an over parameterizer. Now I have two n squared parameters, but the problem is the same problem. I didn't change optimization problem. All the stupid solutions I have before, I still have them. But let's see what happens now if we optimize with gradient descent instead of over w, we're going to optimize with gradient descent over u and v. Okay, so note that what we did was we just changed the optimization algorithm. We're still solving the same problem, just with a different optimization algorithm. Okay, and this maybe is going to go, as somebody asked, can I get really stupid, really, with one algorithm, get really bad solutions? Yes, gradient descent on w gets really bad solutions here. Let's see what happens when we do gradient descent on u and v. Now, as a technicality, and this is, as we said, you can think of it as a two-layer network with linear transfer. Basically, it also gives you this matrix factorization. So this is very similar to what we're doing when we're using multi-layer networks. Now, what we're actually going to do, I'm actually going to consider, instead of factorizations of u times v, I'm going to consider symmetric factorizations, u times u. So I'm going to take w to be symmetric positive semi-definite, but that I can do without loss of generality. I mean, you can always kind of, if I have something that's not symmetric positive semi-definite encoded on the off diagonal blocks of my metrics and get turn it into positive semi-definite. So that's not going to bother us. Okay, so this is what we get. Okay, so this is the empirical results. So what we train here is one with gradient descent and W became X, as I promised. So one with gradient descent on W and once with gradient descent on U. Okay? So both of them are good optimization algorithms in the sense that both find a zero-error solution, both find a global minima. Okay? But in terms of generalization, gradient descent on X is horrible in terms of generalization, and we understand why. It doesn't touch the unobserved entries. It only fixes observed entries and doesn't generalize at all. But the amazing thing is if I do gradient descent on U, so train the same way I train a neural network, even though the problem is completely stupid and overdetermined, lo and behold, I actually get excellent generalization. And now I actually can also ask what happens if I slightly tweak the optimization algorithm. So this is gradient descent with exact line search. If instead of doing gradient descent with exact line search, I'm going to do gradient descent with a fixed small line step size. So in terms of optimization, this is the worst optimization algorithm in the sense it's going to take me much longer to optimize. I'm not showing it here, but it's going to take me much longer to optimize. I'm still going to get to a zero solution, but after many more iterations. But in terms of the quality of, you know, how good is my global optimizer, it's even better. It actually gives me an even better tester on the unobserved entries. Okay, so what we're seeing here is exactly the phenomena that we saw with neural networks. If I use a way overparameterized network, okay, I actually do generalize well. Okay, and can we understand what's going on here? So in particular, okay, so, yeah. So I had it there. Okay, so you should ask not how did I generate the data? So I mean, I generated the data here in a way that could actually be, that I have a chance of generalizing. So I took X star to be approximately low rank, and then, so I generated data actually by applying, I took random linear observations and applied them to an approximately low rank, metrics. So I have it definitely is possible to generalize, but not by solving this square problem. I mean, solving this least square by itself is not going to get me anywhere. So I must be doing something else here, okay? N. Number of hidden units is N. Okay, so N inputs and N hidden units. Yes. Okay, so can we understand what's going on here? In particular, can we characterize which of the many global minima does gradient descent converge to? And the answer in this case is yes. So what I plotted in addition is the minimum trace norm solution. So minimum nuclear norm solution. So the minimum nuclear norm solution we know actually does give us good generalization guarantees if the data was generated in this way, okay? And what we see is, in fact, we get the same generalization properties in the nuclear norm solution. In fact, if you look at the nuclear norm, we also get this, we actually do recover the minimum nuclear norm solution, okay? And so what we can understand that's happening here, what it seems that's happening here, is that note that the nuclear norm was not part of our formulation. You know, our formulation was just minimize the training error, minimize the squared loss. No nuclear norm. But by choosing to do gradient descent over the factorization UV, we're implicitly biasing ourselves towards the minimum nuclear norm solution. So now I want to emphasize I can separate here the generalization part with the inductive bias part. One part I can say is that it seems that when we're actually doing gradient descent over U and V, we're biasing towards a minimum nuclear norm solution. This doesn't have to do with any statistical properties, okay? And this is a property of the optimization. Now I can say that if I actually get the minimum nuclear norm solution, I understand how well it generalizes. That I already know. I don't need to for this specific case. So I can kind of break up here the issue of what is the bias of the optimization and how is this bias in optimization actually lead to good generalization properties. Okay, let me just, for John, because I think I'm going to be kicked off this here very exactly. Okay. So the informal conjecture here is that, you know, at least if the step size is small enough and they start close enough to the origin, I'm going to get the minimum of term solution. To make this a bit more formal, I have to go to think of this crowd, I don't have to spend too much time on this, I have to go to the infinitesimal time limit, look at the gradient flow instead of gradient descent. So this is the gradient flow on U, but what we're interested in is dynamic in terms of W, in terms of the metrics. So we can write the dynamics in terms of W, in terms of dynamics in terms of U, and the interesting thing here, in the continuous time limit, this doesn't happen in discrete time, the dynamics in W, this induces dynamics in W, it can be described solely in terms of W. So I have these, this is a complete description for dynamics in W. R is just the residuals. So I have your dynamics in W, there's some local dynamics in W. They are not the gradient descent dynamics, or gradient flow dynamics in W. The gradient flow dynamics in W actually don't lead me to a good place. But my claim is if I follow these alternative dynamics in W, then I do get to the minimum nuclear solution. Okay? And now, again, to get the minimum nuclear solution, this goes back to initialization. I have to initialize infinitesimally close to the origin. I can't initialize at the origin because that's a saddle point. But the conjecture is that if I initialize infinitesimally close to the origin in some direction of a lower rank solution, then these dynamics would converge to exactly the minimum nuclear solution. And again, I'm going to have to skip over all this, which is unfortunate, but that's okay. And just say that what we can actually, so this is where conjecture we started. We can prove this in a very limited case when the measurement matrices commute with each other. This is not a very interesting case, but this is the most we can prove. It was also proved a bit later by Tang Yumai and his students, and that also proved this in another special case, and this is when the observation matrices are incoherent, are kind of come from are randomly chosen, and the data actually comes from a lower rank matrix. Our claim is this holds even with LD. So these are the conditions necessary for recovery. Our claim this holds even if those conditions are not met. Not exactly, at least. So, I mean, we have some hand-wavy arguments about why it's approximately behaves like this in the general case. We now understand it's not exact. New nuclear solution, but approximate. I think this is a very interesting problem. I'm sorry that I didn't have time to describe all the gaps here. There's lots of gaps needed to understand what's going on here, but it does seem that generally we get to the new nuclear solution here, and we do have some understanding of why. But let's now, 2 minutes, I'm gonna need just 4 minutes. Sorry, okay. Okay, so we looked at so far we looked at implicit bias in these linear regression problems for least square problems. And what we saw is for gradient descent, it looked very simple. So I mean, if I want to study something, the first thing I start is least square problems. And I square there, what could be simpler? And in fact, for gradient descent, we got a very satisfying solution, minimum norm solution. For metric circularization problem, we kind of got an answer that was sort of satisfying, but I mean, it was very difficult to get it. First of all, it's very delicate and only holds for infinitesimal step sizes, and if you start infinitesimally close to the origin, and also it doesn't really hold, it's only approximate and we can't really prove it, and it's very difficult to analyze. Okay? We can also ask, and this is, I think, related to what Andrea asked, what happens if instead of doing gradient descent, we do mirror descent, or we do steepest descent in W? And you'd expect that in the same way that this goes to minimum norm solution, that here we'd go from do mirror descent, we'll go to the minimum psi solution. If we do steepest descent, we'll go maybe steepest descent with respect to some norm, we'll go to the minimum norm solution for that norm. It turns out that's not the case. That's not the case even if you use infinitesimal step sizes and initialize at the origin and do the, you know, try to make it work in any way possible. You cannot characterize it in terms of a minimum solution. In fact, you can't characterize it kind of at all. It depends on the weights of equations, something like that. You cannot get a clean characterization here. And also, in particular, even for coordinate descent, we know this. And this shouldn't surprise us, because at least for coordinate descent, we know this doesn't happen. So for coordinate descent, I mean, this is basically kind of similar to Lars, and we know that Lars, and people are familiar with Lars and Nassau, we know that Lars is related to the minimum L1 norm, but it's not exactly the same as the minimum L1 norm. So it seems that actually the case for squared loss is actually kind of complicated. But instead of the squared loss, what we're going to look at in the remaining, how many more minutes I can steal here, that is, we're going to look at the logistic loss instead. So logistic loss, it's going to have two advantages for us. One, that's actually the loss used in practice for deep learning. And the second is, as we'll see, we'll actually be able to get much cleaner characterizations much easier for the logistic loss. So we'll start for logistic loss, even just linear regression with logistic loss. So you can think of it as a network with one unit, right? Linear network, okay? And in this case, we have, say, the data is linearly separable, so you can actually get zero error. But there are many different ways of getting zero error, okay? So now we can ask, where's gradient descent going to converge to? Okay? So we're doing the same gradient in our experiment on the loss, where is it going to converge to? So the answer is, I think I mentioned several times, it's not going to converge, it's going to diverge. Because to get to drive the logistic loss to zero, you have to drive the predictions to infinity, so you have to drive the weights to infinity. So actually it's going to diverge. In which direction it's going to diverge? So it's going to diverge in some direction it separates the data. So if you take any direction it separates the data and then go in this direction, I'm going to drive the loss to zero. So any of these directions is a legitimate direction to go towards zero error. But there are many such directions. So really what I'm asking now is not exactly which direction do I converge, but which direction do I diverge in? Okay? Any guesses? So I'm going to diverge in some direction that separates the data. There are many directions that separates the data. Which direction? Is the question clear? What do you mean the closest one? Okay, so I didn't choose. I mean, I'm telling you exactly what I'm doing. All I'm doing, I'm going to list this objective, and I'm going to do gradient descent on this objective. Okay, so what I get is the good guess. It's the right guess. What I guess is the max margin solution. So what I'm going to diverge to is exactly the kind of hard margin SVM solution. So the solution that, so not that I can't just say minimum norm because I'm going to go to infinite norm, but it's a solution that after I normalize it has the minimum norm solution subject to getting everything not just in the correct side, but with sort of an output margin of one. So this is the L2 hard margin SVM solution. Let's skip this. And now we can extend this. So this is, and now for the logistic loss, it seems now we can extend it to a bunch of this different things. So now, for example, we can extend this result also for steepest descent and get that if I do steepest descent, I exactly get to the max margin solution with respect to the norm by which I'm doing steepest descent. Can get this also for coordinate descent. I can get it also for metric factorization. And now when I look at metric factorization, I can initialize anywhere. I can take finite step sizes. The result is much more robust. So it seems that looking at this logistic loss is so we can understand the implicit bias also for logistic regression, and now we can have a much cleaner connection between geometry and optimization bias. The last thing I really want to say is go to linear neural nets. So we do want to, let me just go through it quickly. So let's turn now to linear neural networks. So linear neural networks, we already saw them quite a bit. I don't have to describe them again. So it's the same architecture, but all the transfers are linear. So linear neural networks are really stupid because linear neural networks just represent a linear transformation at the end of the day. Okay? So they're really, and we're talking about linear neural networks with a single output unit. So it's just a strange way to parameterize a linear transformation. Right? Any linear neural network implements a linear predictor. And so when I talk about training a linear neural network, really what I'm doing is I'm just training a linear predictor. Okay? So really all I'm doing is just choosing a different parameterization for linear predictors. But we already saw with the metric factorization that when I change the parameterization, I might actually change the geometry of optimization because I'm changing, sort of morphing things around and changing the parameterization. Okay? So you can still ask, if I do gradient descent on beta, on the actual predictor, I know I get the max margin solution. What happens if we do gradient descent on the weights of a network that's a different parameterization for this linear transformation? Okay, and again, it's actually going to diverge. So what I'm going to look at is which direction does it diverge? Okay, so what are the answers? So let's start with a fully connected network. So if I have a standard fully connected network and with any number of layers, any number of weights, single output unit, then it turns out that the bias I get is exactly the same as before. I'm going to converge much slower, but I'm still going to converge exactly to the max margin solution. So minimum L2 norm subject to constraint. So this is kind of very boring. Okay? So why am I so excited to show you this if this is so boring? So if we go instead of a fully connected network, we're going to look at a convolutional linear network. So what's a convolutional linear network? So I can think of a one-dimensional convolution. So I have a one-dimensional signal. And in each layer, I apply what we call a convolution. It's not, I mean, I apply a cyclic convolution to the previous layer. So I have my weights at each layer. I just have, if I have d inputs at each layer, I have just have d weights, and for each unit I use the same weights, just shifted by one. Okay.
Same dimension.
Okay. And so this still just implements a linear transformation. At the end of the day, this still just implements a linear transformation, a linear predictor, and it can be any linear predictor. So again, this is just a different way of overparameterizing linear predictors. But now, what do I get when I do granny descent with respect to this parameterization? Any guesses? Is the question clear? So I'm going to learn a linear predictor. The question is, which linear predictor am I going to get to? I'm going to learn a linear predictor that separates the data, that has zero error, that's a global optima. Which linear predictor that separates the data I'm going to get if I do granny descent on the weights of a linear convolutional network? Any guesses? Something with a 50, right. So what I get is, if I use a single convolutional layer, so two layers, what I get is the linear predictor that with a max margin with respect to, or that kind of, you can think of it as that minimizes the L1 norm in the frequency domain. It's sparse in the frequency domain. More than that, if I add multiple layers, so remember, in the fully connected networks, it doesn't matter how many layers I added, I actually didn't change the implicit bias. Here, when I had multiple layers, I get more sparsely in the frequency domain. I get an LP, I get a bridge penalty in the frequency domain. So I get an LP regularization frequency domain where P behaves as 2 over the depth. So I get, like, with 10 layers, I get something like 0.2 sparsely, P equals 0.2 sparsely in the frequency domain. This is a non-convex, right? So the statement here is correct. It's not that I actually minimize that, but I converge to a critical point of this non-convex optimization problem. Right? That's the best kind of I can hope to say here, right? So this looks like this, right? I have, just to show you, this is with a fully connected, I get, this is the beta I recover, the linear predictor. It's just kind of like all over the place. With the two convolution layers and with 5 convolution layers, it already looks really just like a super sparse in the frequency domain. Okay, so what this allows us, the reason it was important for me to show that, and I know I'm kind of ridiculously behind time here, but I think there was quite a bit of discussion, is that note that what I did here is I didn't change, when I changed this architecture, you know, I added more layers. What does adding more convolution layers do? It does nothing. It doesn't actually change the architecture. And, you know, people in Quora even ask this, okay, how is it useful to add another layer that doesn't do anything? I have the same class, the same model class, okay? What we're seeing here is that changing the architecture, even in a way that actually doesn't change the model class, has a huge effect. And the reason it has a huge effect is because it changes, in my mind, the geometry over which I'm optimizing, okay? So my view over deep learning in general, and this goes back, maybe now I can restate what I said before, is that really when you're training a deep network, the thing you should think about is you're training an infinitely wide deep network, because you're truncating them, you're using a finite number of units, but that's only for convenience. I mean, really you should be using an infinite number of units. And you're all your capacity, so you can represent any function. Okay, so these approximation results we said in the beginning are true. Any function you can represent over with your models. And we can also know that because we can fit any data. So the space of functions you're optimizing over, your hypothesis class, really is the space of all functions. And so your inductive bias is not coming from constraining that function class. All your inductive bias is coming from is the fact that even though you could potentially get to any function, the function you're actually going to get to is a function that's kind of close to where you started in terms of some geometry. And all your inductive bias is coming from this geometry. And this geometry comes from a combination of two things. It's the intrinsic geometry of the optimization algorithm. For example, Euclidean geometry if you're using gradient descent, although it becomes a bit more complicated for non-convex problems, and the parameterization in which you choose. So these two things together, and the parameterization comes from the architecture. So the effect of the architecture, in my mind, is not, the architecture is very important, but its effect is not in limiting what you can do, but rather in changing the geometry under which you optimize, which changes where you're gonna, and where your optimization is gonna end up. Okay, I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you. Well, there has been a lot of discussion during the talk, but we can keep a couple of questions.
Maybe people didn't ask questions during the talk. So, yeah.
there was a link.
I was curious about your matrix factorization example. So you had this example where you generated the data with rank 2, Did you, and then you looked at rank N of the students, say?
Yeah.
Did you look how things change on the rank of the student? I mean, I would expect the starting from 2, it's already really good, but does it get better?
So we did look at that. It depends how you generate it. I have to admit, I don't remember for the specific generation that I showed here, how that specific generation looked when we looked at a function of rank of the student. But if I look in terms of rank of the student, it never kind of, in our experiments, I mean, I know how to generate experiments in which it would go up. But in our experiments, we didn't see it go up, and it usually went down. But I know how to generate data that will have, I mean, I was discussing it yesterday. I haven't actually done this experiment, but I think I can generate data that curve would look like this. Okay? This is the rank of the student.
And the cusp would not be at the rank of the teacher.
Sorry?
And that cusp would be at the rank
of the teacher. So the teacher, the teacher would have, for this thing, the teacher would be a the teacher would be a specific full rank teacher. If the rank of, can I do this with a bounded rank teacher? I'm not sure. Okay. So note that in our examples, we always added, we're approximately low rank. We're not exactly low rank. Okay. The main reason we chose the data to be approximately low rank and not exactly low rank is because I did not want the minimum nuclear norm solution to be the planted solution. Because I wanted to distinguish about whether I'm recovering the planted solution or whether I'm recovering the minimum nuclear norm solution. And if it was exactly low rank, I would have actually recovered the planted solution. And so from my perspective, it would be a bit less interesting. But that's just a choice of why we did the simulations the way we did. It's not, okay.
So most interesting global optimization problems in physical science can all be shown to be NP-hard. But some of them, and some of the most interesting, are actually easy. So a naturally evolved protein can fold. A lump of sodium chloride can form a crystal. The number of local minima is greater than for a deep learning neural network. Right. How is it possible? And the answer is that the underlying energy landscape is funneled.
Is what, I'm sorry?
Funneled.
Okay.
So it's not an unbiased search, it's a biased one, biased by the organization of the landscape. Small neural networks, at least the ones that have been done, also have a funneled structure. I can't say anything about, those are all underdetermined. I can't say anything about overdetermined.
So the other one question to ask is, when you say that small neural networks are funneled, are you referring to random networks or random data, or for real? Because those are two very different objects.
Real.
Okay. So I'd be interested in seeing that.
But you'll laugh because they're very small.
Okay.
And maybe a related question. The part you skipped about optimization, do you want to give us a sense of this?
Yeah, sure. I can give, okay. Why don't I give the summary slide there, which really is the kind of the bad news slide. No, this is, okay. So the summary there is that that we don't really know. We know we have some recent progress, and yet we don't know anything. So all the examples, there are a bunch of examples. Okay, I'm not going to get to it. Okay, there are a bunch of examples in which we can prove that every So there are a bunch of problems in which we can prove. This is not the slide. I got tired of pressing back. There are many cases in which we can prove that if we do local search over start from random initialization and I do local search, I get to the global optima or recover a minimum error solution. All those papers that I'm aware of are all cases in which it's also easy to solve the problem in a different way. So one category of papers, which is what I actually talked about, there's several papers. Nikos, I think you started, you have some papers of that we build on, and that show that for metrics vectorization problems, for example, if you have conditions that allow recovery, that allow recovery using convex relaxations, then under similar conditions, also if you do gradient descent, it'll also work. So, but again, this is situations where we know the problem is easy because we know convex relaxations work, and now we can also prove that local search also works. Another category is problems like PCA. So PCA is a non-convex problem, and we can prove that local search works for that. But you know, we can also solve it by, you know, by linear algebra. Okay. And the third category is for deep networks. There's a flurry of results that prove that for certain deep networks, if you do gradient descent, you get to global minima, typically to a zero error solution. All of these results, all of them are in way overdetermined systems where it's dead easy to get to find a zero error solution. Like that if I asked you to find a zero error solution, you wouldn't need to do gradient descent. You would just, you know, hard code the solution, and you know, it's so overparameterized that it's super easy to construct a zero error solution. So these results are still interesting because they show that even if you do gradient descent from random initializations, you'd still get there, which is not a trivial statement. But we're starting to build an understanding of how local search could work, even in ways where we already knew before, more sophisticated or more direct or more combinatorial methods work. But as far as I know, we currently don't have maybe any result that shows how local search works where it was not, you know, where it wasn't previously known, or it's not like dead easy to solve the problem directly. That's the gist of, what I was planning on showing is going through some of these examples of local search working for metric structurization problems where the problems are also recoverable using SDP relaxations, but I mean, this is the general gist.
So you have the time for two very quick questions.
There is something I missed. So at the beginning you explained that if you look at the test error as a function of number of parameters, you would expect in, let's say, low dimension is that you would expect overfitting, and instead there is no overfitting. Right. Then you say, yeah, but what is important is the optimization algorithm that has an inductive bias. Right. But in all your arguments on the optimization algorithm, where the dimension played the role?
I didn't. That was the... Yeah. Okay. So that's a good point. So let's separate it to two parts. One is, why do we generalize even if the dimension is infinite? So this is what came up in all the arguments that dimension didn't play a role, and basically are arguing looking at the endpoint of that graph, that if an infinite dimension, it works. So now, what happens if I do have, can people see if I write on the board here? And is there a piece of board I can, okay. So suppose, think of metric factorization. Again, the only problem I really understand is metric factorization. So think of it, if your learning rule was, you're gonna minimize the nuclear norm, subject to zero error, and rank and a rank constraint. Okay, so let's call this x hat k. Okay, and now let's think of what happens when you increase k. Okay, so as you increase k, and you're only looking at the regime where you can actually get zero error. Okay, so as you increase k, the nuclear norm of x hat k is going to be monotonically decreasing with k, right? Because if I allow a larger rank, I can definitely do everything I did before, but okay. If my complexity control comes from the nuclear norm of the solution, then as I increase k, I'm going to get simpler solutions because I'm going to get lower nuclear norm solutions. And that's probably what's happening there. Except in those figures, it's not the nuclear norm. I can't actually put my finger on what is the norm that's being decreased. But this should, you know, the situation like this explains that phenomenon. Okay. So it was last question there.
I just a quick sort of comment, which maybe is more a philosophical one, but it's sort of coming back to the beginning and which problems one, you know, sort of giving the networks to try to solve. And which certainly there's a preference to give them ones which we can do. I mean, things like the vision, right? Or ones that we're sort of interested in. Yeah. And we can't do a lot of the things that are presumably all the worst case ones that the network can't do either. And so, I mean, if one, you know, sort of takes a view that there's something connected between how we do things and how these deep networks are doing things, then maybe the fact that some of these problems aren't so hard is not so surprising.
Yeah, so to me, I understand the argument. And philosophically, to me, that's an not unsatisfying argument, because let me rephrase that.
Oh, I agree completely. Yeah, yeah. It was a point rather than an argument. But
yeah, because yeah. Basically what you're saying is that, well, computers, neural networks can do whatever humans can do, and so if there's a problem that humans can solve, then we can do it with a neural net. But we still don't understand what are, I still, as a putting on a more mathematician hat, I want to characterize what is the space, what is this type of problems that humans, computers, whatever computing machine can do. Yeah. So just saying, oh, it's the same set, to me is, again, as you said, it's a philosophical question.
But it's more the question what one's sort of surprised by, rather than, I obviously agree. So. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Latif, for this wonderful tutorial. And we have 20 minutes for the break.